You're listening to Deviant, a true crime podcast. I'm Mishka.
And I'm Husband Stoff.
And this week we'll be completing our deep dive into the case of Gypsy Rose Blanchard. This is part two of two. If you haven't listened to the first episode on this case, you might want to go back and do that one first of all, otherwise this isn't going to make very much sense. Hello everybody, we're back again.
We are back.
Episode 3. Making a habit out of this.
Yeah.
So last week, when we looked at Gypsy's case, we first of all looked at essentially the way that Dee Dee presented her to the world. Quick recap, essentially she was paraded out there as a very sick child who was paralysed from the waist down, had cancer, had muscular dystrophy, was essentially a terminal patient, and Dee Dee was her full-time carer and extremely devoted mother.
Because Dad wasn't there because apparently he was abusive and stuff, but when reared, it was not true at all.
That's not true at all. Dee Dee presented Gypsy to the world as her terminally ill child, very young, very small, very vulnerable. She received lots of benefits and donations, financial support, free housing, trips to Disney World from the Make-A-Wish Foundation, celebrity meetups, blah, 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 blah. It was all bollocks.
All a crock of
shit. All bollocks. There was nothing wrong with Gypsy. And eventually Gypsy had enough of all of this, and so she murdered her mother with the help of her boyfriend, Nicholas Godejohn.
So it wasn't entirely that there was nothing wrong with her. There was stuff wrong with her. But that's only because she'd said, oh, she's got all these illnesses, and it came with a fuck ton of side effects because she was...
With regards to her medication that she was being meant to
because
take.
Because she was on all this medication, like the stuff that weakened her muscles, made her dribble and stuff.
So in part two of our look into the Gypsy Rose Blanchard case, we're going to look at how Gypsy fell through the cracks of the medical system and the social care system, and how it came to be that in the end, all that she felt she could do was to kill her mother, and how the murder was carried out.
So she didn't necessarily slip through the cracks. She was shoved forcefully by her mother.
She took a running fucking jump, really, didn't she, bless her?
She set her on top of the crack and then just elbowed her in until she got through, no matter how badly it made her suffer.
Oh, darling, you're going to be so angry this week. Do you have any questions before I start from last week?
Only stuff that I'm sure I'm about to learn anyway. Okay. So let's crack on.
Do you want to hold on to them until the end of the class?
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. This week we'll be looking at Gypsy's side of the story, the circumstances of the murder and the consequences Gypsy and Nick face. It is important to remember that the majority of the following discussion comes from Gypsy's perspective, and it is only one account of what happened. Dee Dee is not alive to defend herself and cannot possibly receive a fair trial for the things that she's being accused of posthumously. So it's really important to bear that in mind. I absolutely believe that Dee Dee did abuse Gypsy, and I absolutely believe that Gypsy suffered horribly.
Oh, yeah.
But we only have Gypsy's voice to account for everything that went on within that household.
But, well, not just that. We also have I dare say there's going to be medical records now saying that she's fine. An entire cupboard wardrobe full of fucking medication.
Yeah.
So
it's all the nuances though, isn't it?
We kind of do have some tactile evidence that she wasn't being looked after properly.
No.
The bare minimum.
Bare minimum.
Yeah.
Dee Dee failed in her duty of care.
Just a bit.
It is also important to note that while Dee Dee was alive, she did not receive a diagnosis of Munchausen by proxy, and she can't receive one now that she's dead. She can't be given any formal assessment. All that can be done is to look back at the evidence available from that time and hypothesise. Nobody can say definitively that they have all the answers, and I personally even feel that that includes Gypsy, as I say. Gypsy's actually said that she hasn't even told her own lawyers the entire truth. So while I do believe that she was subjected to a great deal of suffering, I also believe that accepting everything that she tells us without question is sort of a bit of a slippery slope, and I would say that about anybody, really. You should never believe everything that anybody tells you. Fair?
I have been to the moon, though.
I know you've been to the moon.
There you go.
I know you've been to the moon.
Okay.
So first of all, as promised last week, I wanted to have a proper look at what is Munchausen by proxy. Munchausen syndrome / Munchausen by proxy is actually not the correct medical term for these behavioural disorders. It is known in the USA as factitious disorder or factitious disorder imposed on another, according to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders by the American Psychiatric Association. Try saying that when you're drunk. In the UK, it's known as fabricated or induced illness. Interestingly, both factitious disorder and factitious disorder imposed on another are recognised as mental disorders in America, but in the UK, it's actually only fabricating or inducing illness in oneself that's recognised as a mental illness, and doing the same thing to another, so by proxy, that's just seen by law in the UK as a case of abuse. It's not treated as a mental disorder. So I just thought it was quite different, quite interesting that there's a distinction between the two countries.
That's a bit different.
Given what we're dealing with, though, it's very hard to quantify at the end of the day, isn't it?
How do you mean?
In terms of, you know, are you just a bastard or are you ill? It's not like you can, you know, test for it like you can anemia or whatever.
Observable behavioural patterns, though.
That is part of the diagnostic criteria, yeah.
That's the thing. When it comes to mental health, you can't really... It's not like you can do a blood test and go, ah, bang, you got... you think you're Elvis. You know, if someone walks, talks, pretends that they're Elvis, chances are they got King complex from Theme Hospital, even, you know?
It's the legal sort of take on it. It's not necessarily something that I agree with. It's just how it's treated in the UK in a court of law. And I suppose that's because the priority is safeguarding the child / victim and not the abuser. So fair enough. I can kind of understand it. Don't necessarily agree with it. Think that the abuser should be given treatment, but I can see the stance.
Yeah.
But in America, it's treated as a mental illness the same as if they were doing it to themselves.
But also abuse?
And abuse.
Yeah, okay.
It's called medical abuse. Both in the States and the UK, it is acknowledged that both the self-imposed and the externally abusive behaviours that usually occur with these disorders typically occur with comorbidities of other personality disorders. So you will find that a lot of people that present with factitious disorder also have something like antisocial personality disorder, which is colloquially called sociopathy. And that includes things like a lack of empathy, disregard for others, manipulation, aggression, all those kind of personality traits. And also they see quite often an overlap with borderline personality disorder. So that's things like emotional instability, very sort of highly strung between emotions. You can yo-yo between them very quickly. Impulsive behaviour, disturbs patterns of thinking or perceptions, and intense but unstable relationships with others that don't last for a long period of time. Not a qualified psychologist in any way, shape or form, just what I found in my reading.
What about narcissism?
Well, I think narcissism comes into sort of these other personality disorders. Okay. It's... Narcissism can be both a condition and a symptom, I believe. There's a lot of overlap between these various disorders.
Because what I'm picking up from the general situation is, my daughter is very ill. Look how good I am at looking after her. Mm-hmm. Look at me.
The name Munchausen syndrome stems from an 18th century novel, Baron Munchausen's narrative of his marvellous travels and campaigns in Russia. In this book, the main character, Baron Munchausen, is known to tell increasingly fantastical stories about his adventures, including things like riding on a cannonball in mid-flight, wrestling a 40-foot alligator, and travelling to the moon. It's a complete satire. It's a comedy. It's not meant to be taken seriously. It's a satire of a real baron at the time who was known to tell rather outlandish stories at parties and wasn't very fond of this book about him. There's a strong implication throughout the book that the Baron is lying and that he's doing so because he enjoys the attention that his stories bring to him. In 1951, Richard Asher, a British endocrinologist and haematologist, was the first medical professional to describe factitious disorder in a published article. He wrote this article after he'd spent some time observing cases in the mental health ward at Central Middlesex Hospital. He likened the storytelling abilities of those that he encountered with factitious disorder to the famous literary character, and colloquially, the name Munchausen syndrome stuck. I'm going to try and use the correct medical term of factitious disorder moving forwards, just because obviously you don't want to perpetuate incorrect names for things. I might struggle with it a little bit. It has a lot of S's in it.
Munchausen syndrome.
Munchausen's is not the medical term.
Okay. From now on, I shall call it munchies.
It's factitious disorder.
Share a case of munchies.
Share a case of the munchies. So at its core, factitious disorder is about either faking, exaggerating, or causing injury or illness in order to garner attention for the individual. But it's when another person becomes the target of this harm that then it becomes a form of abuse. So factitious disorder imposed on another is statistically one of the most lethal forms of abuse, and it has a mortality rate of up to 10% in known cases. So a lot of these children will die, which was the point that I had to stop in my research and go and eat some ice cream.
Oh.
Yep, that was point one. The majority of perpetrators are women, and their targets are usually vulnerable people, such as children, the elderly, or those who are already vulnerable through illness or disability. In around 85% of cases, it is found to be the mother targeting their own child. Common behaviours in a mother or other caregiver with factitious disorder include: they are usually the child's primary caregiver. They present initially as good carers. They are usually accomplished liars and manipulators. They are normally the only ones consistently present or associated with the onset of the child's symptoms. So when the carers are absent, they have a history of self-induced symptom or illness exaggeration. They may have mental health evaluations that indicate they are normal, air quotes. They may have no prior involvement with child protection services. They may appear to be over-anxious, overprotective, mistaken, or deluded. They may have a background in the health profession or an unusual degree of knowledge about health and medicine. They may seek publicity or attention from a variety of people. Any of this starting to sound familiar?
Most of it, I'd say.
Other warning signs to look out for in an individual that may be presenting with factitious disorder are: the only person claiming to notice symptoms is the parent or carer. The affected child has an inexplicably poor response to medicine or other treatment. If one particular health problem is resolved, the parent or carer may then begin reporting a new set of symptoms. The child's alleged symptoms do not seem plausible. So, for example, a child that's supposedly lost a lot of blood, they may not actually become unwell at all. There will just be lots of blood on their clothing. But they seem fine.
What?
Yep.
Huh?
That's one of the things that they will do.
Whose blood is it?
It could be the parents, more often than not. The parent or carer has a history of frequently changing doctors or visiting different hospitals for treatment, particularly if their views about the child's treatment are challenged by the medical staff. That's known as doctor shopping. The child's daily activities are being limited far beyond what you would usually expect as a result of having a certain condition. For example, they never go to school or have to wear leg braces even though they can walk properly. Your eyebrows.
it's to keep them ill.
Mm-hmm. The parent or carer does not seem too worried about the child's health, despite being very attentive to them. The parent or carer develops close and friendly relationships with healthcare staff, but may become abusive or argumentative if their own views about what's wrong with the child are challenged. One parent, commonly the father, has little or no involvement in the care of the child. The parent or carer encourages medical staff to perform painful tests and procedures on the child. These are the sorts of tests that most parents would only agree to if they were persuaded to by the doctors that it was absolutely necessary in order for the welfare of their child. So things like Gypsy's muscular dystrophy examination through a muscle biopsy.
Removing sweat glands, saliva glands.
Uh-huh.
So just to check, this list you've got here.
Yeah.
Did you write it based on this case?
No, this comes from a couple of different sources. One of them is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And the other one is the NHS Guidelines to Safeguarding Children from Parents or Carers who are fabricating illness or injury.
But so far, if this was a bingo card, we've won many times already.
Full house!
Wow!
Pretty much, yeah.
What do we win? A cuddly toy and golf tickets.
Mm-hmm. And this is the second part where I had to stop and have a little break because it very nearly made me cry. So ways that the mother or carer may impose illness on the child include deliberately contaminating or manipulating clinical tests to fake evidence of illness. So that, for example, could be things like they add glucose or blood to a urine sample in order to get a positive test result for something like diabetes or blood in the urine. They may place their own blood on the child's clothing to suggest unusual bleeding or heat thermometers to suggest the presence of a fever.
See, it must be a sick story on telly. Oh. Ages ago, someone went to bunk the day off school. So the mum gave him a thermometer. They sit with this under your tongue for a minute. So they put it over the kettle and they gave it back to the mum. And she goes, oh, well, according to this, you're dead.
Isn't that my family?
It could have been.
I seem to remember that.
I can't remember.
I seem to remember that.
But it was like, oh, according to this, you're dead. Well done.
So also, the mother might poison their child with unsuitable or non-prescribed medication or other substances such as salt or cleaning product. They may deliberately infect the child's wounds by injecting the child with dirt or feces or rubbing it into open wound sites. They may induce unconsciousness in the child by suffocating them, and they may also not treat or mistreat any genuine illnesses in order so that they get worse.
Because it's fucking freely for them.
Yeah, and also withhold food, which would result in the child failing to develop physically and also mentally, as well as just generally being in poor health.
So you read a thing on the, basically about how they will put things in the food. Am I misremembering, or did you say that they had like a family member or someone they stayed with them and they started getting ill as well?
Dee Dee stayed with her family after she and Rod divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, they thought that she poisoned her mother or starved her to death. And then they thought that she might have been poisoning her stepmother, Laura, by putting weed killer in her food.
But wasn't there someone else that got ill whilst they were there as well? Or am I misremembering that?
I think you might be misremembering that one.
Okay.
The family speculate about both her mother and her stepmother.
Okay.
Often, other forms of abuse will go hand in hand with factitious disorder, including physical and emotional. And these are strategies adopted by the abuser to maintain control of their victim. And part of the cycle of abuse model that's often used to study domestic abuse cases. Domestic abuse is something that I think is just better understood than medical abuse, but it pretty much overlaps the abusive models a lot of the time. So just like in domestic cases, in medical abuse cases, you'll often see the honeymoon period where the child may be rewarded for perpetuating their abuser's lies about their health, such as with things like trips to Disneyland, convention tickets, etc. There will then be the rise in tension, which will be where the child perhaps makes a slip in public about their condition or says something or does something or maybe nothing at all. But there will be this sort of mounting anger within the parent during this period of time and things will become very, very uncomfortable. And then there's the explosion. And that's where punishment will be doled out on the victim, either by intensified medical abuse or other forms before the cycle begins again. It's a way of maintaining control, it's a way of conditioning the child, and basically it will escalate as time goes on. These cycles become more and more dangerous. I was also doing some reading on some other theories about abusive behaviours as well. Not about abusive behaviours necessarily on their own, but I looked at something called attachment theory, which is the idea that basically a child has to latch on to an adult in their presence from a very early age, because without that adult in their life, they will not survive.
Yep.
So over a course of a normal childhood and normal childhood development and a healthy relationship between adult and child, the attachment will lessen as the child grows increasingly independent and will eventually break the hold between the pair. But in cases where there's abuse, so like child abuse or sort of controlling abuse, like factitious disorder, the abuser will purposefully try and keep that attachment at a very juvenile level in order to retain control of the child. So they won't go through the normal stages of attaching and detaching. They will stay at an infant level of attachment to their parent, despite the fact that they are abusing them.
Because they're nurturing dependency.
Yes, because they have absolute dependency on them.
Yep.
And there is also something else. There's a theory called trauma bonding, which is although you are trapped in this relationship with this person who is doling out incredible suffering upon you, because you are isolated and they are the only other person kind of in your immediate life, the emotional highs and lows of the abusive relationship form an intense bond between the two because it's the only relationship that you have.
Yeah.
And so you can again become increasingly dependent on the abuser and their positive treatment of you when it comes, because it is the only contact you have with somebody else. You get these really, really intense, unhealthy bonds.
Yeah.
And these are the kind of things that people don't consider when people are abused, and they're like, why didn't they just leave? It's so easy to be critical of people. Does my nut in. The only way to resolve a case of medical abuse through factitious disorder is just to remove the child from the situation. Treatment of the perpetrator is not enough. And even after they've removed the child from the situation, if you allow visitation rights to the perpetrator, that can be absolutely disastrous.
Yeah.
Because the moment they get that child alone, even for a second, they are likely to immediately begin their behaviours again.
Yep.
And at that point as well, because it's been a long time, the chances are it will be much more violent. And that could be, you know, at the point where you see a child die, when you think they've removed them from this abusive environment, they let them have visitation rights. And then the next thing you know, the mother might pump them through with a load of salt water that finishes them off while the social worker or whatever nips for a wee. It can be that quick. So they can't have any contact. The only way to basically properly protect the victim and hopefully enable their full recovery is to remove them entirely from the abusive environment for good. And then at that stage, once they are separated, you can offer the perpetrator therapeutic treatment. But there is no going back. There's no going back for that child.
No.
They have to be removed forever. Dee Dee and Gypsy's case seems to hit many of the criteria for factitious disorder imposed on another.
Just many.
Yeah, right on the nose, you know. Dr. Mark Feldman, an internationally recognised expert on factitious disorders and malingering, which is the one where you get financial and material gain by faking illnesses, has stated confidently that in his opinion, Dee Dee had the disorder combined with the malingering. And although it's not an official diagnosis, she can't be given an official diagnosis because she's dead, it is a very qualified opinion from probably one of the leading experts in the world. I trust his judgment.
Yeah, if he knows what he's talking about.
So how was it possible that all of this was missed in Gypsy's case? For Gypsy, the warning signs began early with her diagnosis of sleep apnea at 3 months old. There's also home video footage of a one-year-old Gypsy. Ugh, it's really bizarre to watch, in my opinion. Basically, Dee Dee asks her where her cranium is, and the one-year-old Gypsy points to her head. And then she asks where her phalanges are, and this infant girl wiggles her fingers. So for me, that just seems like a major red flag, because even from the age of one, where she's still developing Gypsy's, you know, sort of language skills, she's teaching her medical terminology. It's like she's coaching her.
It's weird.
It's, yeah, this stuck out to me. I could be paranoid. A cousin of Gypsy's, Bobby Petra, claims that when Gypsy was about 7, he saw her pushing other children around in her wheelchair just to play with them, and actually she even got up and jumped on a trampoline. He also recalls that when Gypsy saw her mother coming when she was playing like this, she would immediately collapse with her legs buckling from underneath her, and it was clear that she was afraid of being caught by her mother acting in a way that was not allowed. Even Rod Blanchard, Gypsy's father, recalls a time when one of Dee Dee's own sisters approached him and told him that his daughter could walk. When Rod questioned Dee Dee about this, she told him that Gypsy would have good days and bad days with her muscular dystrophy, and that she did still have some limited movement remaining, but that she would ultimately become completely paralysed from the waist down because her condition was, after all, degenerative. And Rod, bless him, he accepted this. Gypsy claims that her mother was so convincing that she herself even thought she was ill. She explains to those who interview her now that she knew that she could walk and she knew she was capable of eating, despite the fact that she had a feeding tube, but everything else she believed was true, even that she had cancer. She claims her mother would shave her head while telling her, "Going to fall out anyway, might as well keep it neat," and gave her pills, which were supposedly her cancer medications.
What were they?
I don't know. But you can get pill form of chemotherapy and things. So, could have been sugar pills for all we know.
Yeah. Although looking at that cupboard, I bloody doubt it. if it was sugar pills, then she wouldn't bother with sugar pills because there's no side effects she can then lean on.
She was keeping her on a very careful cocktail of medication, so...
Yep.
Outside of Gypsy's body, the biggest indicator of how drastically the medical system itself failed her is the vast closet of medications discovered in the Blanchard home the day that they recovered Dee Dee's body. Each vial and package is a testament to how medical professionals, unwittingly or not, allowed the abuse to continue.
Surely with medical records, though. You know, because I know when I go to the doctors, they've got the screen and it's got like all my history on there.
Uh-huh.
So 10 minutes after they've put her name in, right, and it's all loaded up, aren't they going to sit there and go, hang on.
What do we have in the UK that they don't have in America?
Electric kettles.
Yes, but apart from that.
What
do we have in Britain that they don't have in America?
NHS?
The NHS.
Ah.
A national healthcare system.
Yep. And she shopped for different doctors, didn't she?
Factitious disorder imposed on another is a misunderstood condition, but I can't help but wonder if part of the reason that Dee Dee was able to continue her treatment of Gypsy as long as she did is because in the United States, medicine is treated like a business. Without a united healthcare system, Dee Dee was able to doctor shop and slip through cracks if ever suspicions might be raised. Something else I thought of as well, apart from that, in America, there's such a culture of medical malpractice suits. I mean, my frame of reference here is things like Scrubs. But they're constantly being sued by their patients. And they're absolutely terrified of it, as far as I can tell, because they're massive lawsuits. So I do wonder how many of these physicians gave Dee Dee what she wanted just to avoid a lawsuit.
Yeah.
That's something that I did consider. Because you can see it, can't you? This sort of seemingly qualified carer / mother going, you don't know what you're talking about. I've cared for her for 15 years. She does this, that and the other.
Yeah.
I've seen her have seizures, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Do you really want to risk it?
Basically bullied them into it.
Yeah. It did cross my mind.
There is definitely a possibility.
There were plenty of indicators in Gypsy's medical records that something wasn't right. Dee Dee would often switch between practitioners, and when taking Gypsy's medical history appointments, it was noted over and over again in her records that everything was on mother's information. Depending on what clinic she went to, so neurology, cardiology, endocrinology, the medical history of the family changed. If she went to a cardiologist, all of her relatives died of heart attacks. If she went to a neurologist, they all had strokes. Because Dee Dee claimed that all of Gypsy's medical records had been lost during the flooding of Hurricane Katrina, there was nothing on paper to refute her. If the doctors did do fresh tests to investigate Gypsy's conditions and they came back negative, Dee Dee would insist on further procedures or change to another specialist until she got what she wanted. When cleaning out the Blanchard home after Dee Dee's murder, a doctor's prescription pad was discovered there, which had clearly been stolen. So this also meant that Dee Dee was filling out her own fraudulent prescriptions and having them filled, but these were never questioned.
Dr. Mantis Toboggan.
Mantis Toboggan. The thing is as well, if you've got a real prescriptions pad...
You can write any old bollocks you want on it.
You can write any old bollocks you want on it, and doctors... I'm assuming in the US it must be the same as here, are so busy that they don't actually sign and date anything properly. They just put a squiggle on it and send it away.
Doctor's handwriting.
You know, because they're so busy, they're just trying to churn it out as quickly as possible. So she could have just, you know, gone blah, 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 along the bottom of the page and the pharmacist would have accepted it because it's on a genuine prescription document.
Yep.
The most astonishing incident, though, of failing to protect Gypsy by the medical community is the case of Dr. Bernardo Flastacine, a paediatric neurologist that began consulting with the Blanchards back in 2007. That name is so hard for me to say.
Dr. Bernardo Flastacine.
Dr. Bernardo Flastacine. And I'm going to say it again, and I'm going to say it clearly, because I think that this man's name should be remembered.
Dr. Banana Plasticine.
Dr. Bernardo Flastacine. Flasterstein noticed that Gypsy did not have the muscular atrophy in her legs that he would normally expect to see in a wheelchair-bound patient. And in fact, Gypsy, in his opinion, seemed to have a completely normal muscle mass. He even had Gypsy stand in his office on her own 2 feet without any support. And he said to Dee Dee, "I can't see any reason why she doesn't walk." Dee Dee argued his observations, though, so Flasterstein did dutifully conduct further tests, such as MRIs of Gypsy's spine and a full blood work on her. Everything came back normal. He also managed to track down some of Gypsy's prior paediatricians back in New Orleans. It turned out that her medical records had not been lost in Hurricane Katrina, and they too were able to confirm that when they had run tests at Dee Dee's behest, they had all come back normal.
Fancy that.
Uh-huh. So it was clear at that point that Gypsy did not have muscular dystrophy, and more than that, that her mother knew she didn't.
There's a butt coming though, isn't there?
There's a big butt coming. There's a huge butt that should be spanked for massive negligence coming.
Do you like big butts? I'm not sure.
I don't like this butt. Yeah. I want to punish this one.
Well, that can be a fun thing, but...
So after his investigations, Flasterstein wrote a letter to Gypsy's primary care doctor, basically outlining his findings. And he noted in this letter, and this is a direct quote, "The mother is not a good historian." More damning than this, though, he actually put in writing in his letter to Gypsy's GP, "There is a strong possibility of Munchausen by proxy." So he spotted it. He knew what it was. In an astounding failure to safeguard Gypsy, he did not report his suspicions to Child Protective Services or even his own superiors. Now, child protection laws require that any medical professional, doctor, nurse, anyone that comes in contact in the medical profession with someone that they suspect is being abused, they must report it to CPS, even if it's only a hunch. This did not happen in Gypsy's case.
Dr. Plasticine, you fucked up.
He fucked up big time.
You fucked up big time.
When he was later pressed about why he didn't raise his suspicions further, Flasterstein's answers make for riling reading. He claims that he had been told by the hospital to treat Dee Dee and Gypsy with golden gloves, and that he felt nobody would believe him. He also said that as he understood it, this makes me want to vomit, child abuse is evidenced by neglect, and that Gypsy was not experiencing neglect, but the opposite. Her mother was over-treating her.
I think your theory is right then.
Mm.
Treating with golden gloves. So there is, from what you've told me so far, It does sound like the hospital is very much aware that if they don't do what she's asking, they're going to be sued.
It could be also the amount of press attention that Gypsy and Dee Dee got. And again, because medicine is treated like a business in the States, That kind of press for the hospital brings in things like donations from benefactors.
I get that, but it's a particular use of the words golden gloves.
Yeah.
To me, that translates to be very careful, do what they ask, for God's sake.
Don't argue with her.
Don't argue with her.
But in my opinion, sorry, not good enough.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, he said that she wasn't being abused because she wasn't being neglected. Dee Dee would request copies of all of Gypsy's medical records. And so she would have seen this letter from Dr. Flasterstein to her GP. And she would have seen him writing that he suspected Munchausen's. And after that, Flasterstein never saw them again. And he didn't follow up at all. I cannot believe that he allowed that to happen. If he was in the UK, I think he'd be struck off.
Yeah, no, I don't doubt that. But again, from what you said, like the treatment with golden gloves, what you said followed up with that on, was he bullied into not doing anything?
No, he just decided it wasn't his problem.
How sure are we of that, though?
He's basically confessed to it.
He's, okay.
So
he's admitted he fucked up.
Yeah, so basically he knew what factitious disorder was. He recognised the warning signs, but he felt that he had done enough by noting it in his letter and that he couldn't go to the authorities because nobody would believe him. And that she wasn't being abused. She just had an overzealous mother.
Well, guess what? You were a little bit wrong there, bucko.
Yep, and I'd just like to point out that the first tenet of the Hippocratic Oath, which is something that doctors in America specifically have to swear, is not sworn in the UK, it's just a code of conduct.
But
in
Wash your hands.
Yeah, wash your hands. But in the US, the first tenet of the Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm.
And what did he do?
He just fucked it spectacularly and subjected her to a further 8 years of abuse.
Well done.
In 2009, somebody else also raised suspicions that not all was as it seemed in the Pink Bungalow on West Volunteer Way. So somebody gave an anonymous tip to the police that they'd suspected that there was abuse occurring within the house. And don't get your hopes up, it wasn't Flasterstein. He vehemently denies that it was him. We don't know who it was, but somebody did report them, and Springfield police made a visit to the home. When they got there, though, Dee Dee was able to convincingly reassure them that everything was fine. Dee Dee would often change her and Gypsy's surname spelling and Gypsy's birth date, and she would shift Gypsy's age so that she was born in 1991, then to 1993, and then finally 1995. She likely did this to continue receiving child benefits and payments from places like the Make-A-Wish Foundation, because obviously you don't qualify if you're over 18. But when police questioned her, she explained that she did all of this to help avoid being traced by her abusive ex-husband. Bollocks. And that the records also had mistakes on them from where they were being remade after they were lost in Hurricane Katrina. The police accepted all of this at face value, and they didn't conduct any further investigation. They did not interview Gypsy on her own away from the presence of her mother. How can you expect a victim to be able to speak up if they are kept in the presence of their abuser? You're so annoyed. Oh, you look so disappointed
so
in the world.
So many people fucked up on this.
So many people fucked up.
Fucking hell.
So after this visit, the police left and submitted a report that, in their opinion, bearing in mind they're police officers, they're not paediatricians, they're not neurologists, they're not psychotherapists, in their opinion, it was clear that Gypsy had, quote, and I hate using this word, but it's what is in the police report, Gypsy clearly has mental retardation. And they, as far as they were concerned, everything was above board. They are not qualified to make that assessment. So angry. People often question when someone is being abused, why didn't they just leave? But unless you've been in that situation, it's difficult to comprehend the level of control that the abuser has over their victim. And that's physically, practically, and emotionally.
She couldn't have gone out if she wanted to anyway.
No.
Not just because of the wheelchair, but if she were to get out of the house, roll down the street a bit, if anyone picked her up, oh, she's got mental retardation. Mm-hmm. Let's take her back to her loving mother who wouldn't do anything to harm her.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they have these accents, because they're clearly not...
I think it's because you're uncomfortable. Often, the victim's identity and sense of self is worn down so much that they are convinced they have nowhere else to go and no one else to turn to. Abusers isolate their targets from others, strip away their practical means, such as access to money, and do everything they can to maintain control. Dee Dee's continuous editing of Gypsy's age meant that in the eyes of the world, she was provably a child, and Dee Dee's tight hold on her was natural. Even Gypsy was not aware of how old she really was. On her 18th birthday, her father Rod called her, excited to make all of the typical dad jokes that fathers look forward to when their child turns 18. But when Dee Dee answered the phone, she told Rod that Gypsy thought that she was only 14 and that to tell her otherwise would upset her a great deal due to her developmental disabilities, and he was not to do so. Rod obeyed because he didn't want to hurt his daughter. When Dee Dee realised that Gypsy's age was becoming an issue she could no longer keep knocking back, she had her daughter declared legally mentally incompetent, meaning that she maintained legal custody of Gypsy and had power of attorney over her. So even turning 18 was not going to be enough to emancipate Gypsy from her mother. She's got such control.
A little bit, yeah.
Such control. Gypsy tells of how her mother had such tight reins on her that when they were out in public together, she would constantly hold her hand. This was not a sign of affection. It was so that if Gypsy said anything that may be out of line, Dee Dee would squeeze her fingers tight to reel her in. And there's actually video footage of her doing this. It looks affectionate when you don't know what's happening. And then I saw it zoomed in on an interview that they were giving after they were moved into the Habitat for Humanity house. And you see her do it and she is crushing her fingers. Gypsy actually puts her other hand over the top to hide it from the camera. It's so upsetting.
She's a piece of shit.
She was a very disturbed lady. As Gypsy began to grow older, though, doubts of her illness began to surface within her own mind. Puberty is a very powerful force, and no matter how much control Dee Dee had, she could not force Gypsy's burgeoning womanhood back into the box. Gypsy began to long for romance and all the freedom that a fairy tale love affair would bring. Raised on a steady diet of Disney movies, these shaped her understanding of how romantic love worked, because she didn't have any social exposure to her peers in order to develop any other. She had use of the internet, and since Dee Dee even had control over her access to Facebook, thanks to their shared accounts, at night she began to wait until her mother went to sleep and then sneak onto the laptop to create secret accounts under different names so that she could reach the outside world and look for the love that she was craving. So now we're going to see a few times where Gypsy did actually try to escape. She made a go of it. In 2010, Gypsy turned up on a neighbour's doorstep. She was walking and wearing a long blonde wig. Yep, she was walking. She didn't have a wheelchair.
Where'd she get the wig?
She's a cosplayer.
Oh, fuck yeah, of course.
She begged them to be given a ride to a nearby hospital as her boyfriend, a man in his 30s that she'd met on Facebook, had been in a fight and was injured. The neighbours actually took her to the hospital, and when she arrived, Gypsy had brought a birth certificate with her. She showed to the staff there, proving that she was 18 so that she could have rights to visitation to this man. So she made a go of it, but Dee Dee found her within a couple of hours. She came to the hospital with her own birth certificate that stated that Gypsy was 14. She accused the badly injured man of being a paedophile, threatened him with legal action, and then took Gypsy away again. So that's attempt one. Your face. The disbelief. If you roll your head, your eyes any further back into your head, they're going to pop out.
Okay.
Okay. The second time that Gypsy made a bid to break free was in 2011. She was attending a sci-fi convention with her mother and their friends Kim and Dave. And Dave was the one that found Dee Dee's body and Kim was his wife that did the candlelight vigil. Do you remember from episode one? She met up with a man there that she'd struck up an online friendship with. And while there, she managed to tell him what was happening at home. This man believed her, and he promised to take her away to safety, telling her that she could come and live with him in Arkansas. So Gypsy, absolutely desperate, agreed and got into his car. He was basically a stranger, but she was so desperate to get away, she went with him and he took her back to his hotel. Within 4 hours, through the combined efforts of Kim and Dave, who were just worried for Gypsy and thought that she was this vulnerable little girl, along with all the convention staff, Dee Dee once again found Gypsy, told this man that she was a minor, and took her away again, threatening to call the cops on him if he ever came near her again. According to Gypsy, once they got home from this, Dee Dee took out a hammer and smashed both her laptop and her cell phone before telling her, if you ever try to do that again, I'll smash your fingers too. She then, according to Gypsy, chained her to her bed with a dog leash and a pair of handcuffs for the next 2 weeks as punishment. It was also at this stage that she had the papers drawn up to declare Gypsy mentally incompetent. And friends say that there was a notable change in Dee Dee's behaviour at this time. So she became much more withdrawn and anxious. And they just put it down to the fact that a mother had been scared to death of almost losing her child. Gypsy claims that the abuse worsened during this period for about the following year. And she would just refer to this period as the bad times.
Yeah, I can believe that I can believe the abuse got worse because she nearly lost control of her subject.
Yep.
Her victim. So she's going to want to, like, break her will if she can, so she doesn't try and escape again, so she can still kind of lord over her and say, look at my ill daughter.
And it almost seems too much to believe, but then you look at cases like the Turpin 13, where all those kids were chained to their beds at all times and things like that in their own feces, and you think, oh yeah, actually that shit does happen.
We're going to do the Turpin 13. Not for a little while after this one, though. There's only so much child abuse I can take at once.
Any more attempts to escape?
Well, we shall continue. So, yeah, during this period, she claimed that Dee Dee would whip her with wire coat hangers and withhold food, as well as other physical violence. But Gypsy's will was still not broken. The electronics were eventually replaced, and in 2012, Gypsy joined a Christian dating website. So once again, she started looking for love. And this is how she first made contact with Nicholas Godejohn. Nicholas Godejohn, 23 at the time that he and Gypsy first began talking, had troubles of his own. He was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, which can result in difficulty interacting with others, forming meaningful and long-term relationships, and difficulties in some social situations. Individuals with Asperger's can come across as socially awkward, not necessarily registering things like humour or sarcasm as other people might, but as opposed to other disorders on the autistic spectrum, people with Asperger's do normally want to make friendships and form relationships and fit in. It's just that they have some trouble doing so. In Godejohn's case, it seemed that he was more comfortable interacting with people online rather than face-to-face, which is totally understandable when you think about it. You don't have to do things like make eye contact, you have time to assess messages and think about your responses, and you don't feel the same level of pressure. I feel more comfortable online than face-to-face. I have the social skills of a teaspoon in person.
You're a very pretty spoon.
No. Yes. I'm a very round teaspoon.
I'll spoon you.
I want to be the little spoon. Godejohn's parents would say that they often tried to encourage him to get out into the real world, but he preferred his computer, and his mother claimed that he had a developmental and emotional age of around 15 years old. Godejohn also had an IQ of 82, which is below the median average of around 100 for adults. This is not due to his Asperger's, though, and I want to make that very clear. The two are not related. In fact, if anything, normally in Asperger's, you'd expect to see a raised IQ score. You tend to find that a lot of them will even be on the genius scale, so the two are not intertwined. Godejohn also believed that he had multiple personalities, although his descriptions and behaviours do not fit someone with dissociative identity disorder, in my opinion. Again, I'm not a qualified therapist, but he does not also appear to have ever been formally diagnosed with DID. It's going to be something that we cover in another episode because I think it's amazing and absolutely fascinating. But just to bust a few myths quickly that claims like Godejohn's might help perpetuate, dissociative identity disorder does not cause people who live with it to be violent. It is not about playing pretend or making up imaginary versions of oneself. It is an incredible defense strategy by a person's mind that has been developed to protect them from severe childhood trauma. And it fractures the mind in order to separate, compartmentalize, and protect an abused child against the experiences that they are having. It is a defense mechanism, and it is an amazing one, in my opinion. Godejohn claims that he used to hear voices, but these then absorbed and became part of himself. He also claimed to have an evil side of himself. He states that this is a 500-year-old vampire called Victor who enjoyed killing. Given that Godejohn has not been diagnosed with DID, and in my limited opinion, his behaviours don't seem to fit the known criteria for diagnosis, it seems to me pretty safe to say that these multiple personalities that he claims to have are actually just wild fantasies that have been constructed by a lonely young man. In 2012, when Godejohn and Gypsy began communicating online, they were both vulnerable, isolated people starving for affection. Gypsy told Nick that she was in a wheelchair and that she had health issues, and she was swept up by Nick when he replied that he didn't care and he thought she was perfect and pure. The messages between them do start off innocuously enough. The two were planning their ideal vacations, their wedding in the snow, the names of their future children. But over time, Godejohn began to indoctrinate Gypsy into the world of BDSM culture. Now, to be very clear, Between consenting, informed adults, BDSM is a perfectly natural and healthy form of sexual exploration. I am not here to kink shame anybody. You know, for anybody who knows what they're doing and understands what they're doing, BDSM is great. Go for it. Paddy yourselves until the cows come home. The problem is that Gypsy had no prior template for sexual intimacy. She had been infantilized by her mother, and so to go from this kind of childish extreme of Disney romance to the world of sadomasochistic sex was a massive leap. Gypsy claims she wasn't actually keen on the BDSM at first, but Goldujahn persuaded her to just try it with him. He taught her that the male was to be dominant and that she as the female was to be submissive. That's not how it works. As far as I understand it, the sub and the dom roles are not dependent on gender.
Nope.
It's just of how you establish your particular relationship with your partner / partners.
Yeah, this is not always in that particular way. I mean, no. The Amazon position exists for reasons.
Death by schnoo schnoo. But this is what he is teaching her. And the problem is that given that Gypsy had always been conditioned to be obedient throughout her entire life, she just accepted that. And it's all too easy to see how that she slotted into this behaviour in a new fetishised way. It makes perfect sense when you look at it. Nick also told Gypsy that he wanted each of his personalities to have their own girlfriend, and that she should create characters for each of them, that she would then cosplay for him and they would interact as their pairs across 5 separate Facebook accounts. These characters included Kitty, who was a little girl, Ruby, who was Gypsy's dark side, and Candy, who was a bubbly, fun-loving character with rainbow hair. And in my opinion, this is just another indicator that Nicholas didn't actually have dissociative identity disorder, because in DID, you do get systems that do get into romantic relationships and have significant others with other people. And normally it's the host system that would be romantically involved with someone. And the alters within that system would understand their relationship and respect it. And it would be kind of a mutual respect thing. But they're not expected to kind of pair the spare. So the other alters within the system, they're unlikely to feel any sort of romantic attachment or sexual attraction to their host partner. It's just kind of a consent thing where, yes, we're just going to switch off and look the other way and you guys do what you do. Now, there is one couple on YouTube that I follow where both members of the couple both have DID. And within their systems, they have alters that have relationships across them with each other, but it's not every single alter paired off with every single alter of someone else. So I think they've got 3 relationships between the two systems, but many more personalities. And it's not a case of you just kind of slot everybody together into a neat fit. It's extremely complex because these are real developed personalities with their own wants and desires. And the way I see it, why would you want to be paired off with an imaginary friend? You'd want a real relationship, not this made-up character that doesn't really exist. There's no actual intimacy in that scenario. And these are living, breathing people in the same body. But Nick had Gypsy role-play these characters for his, quote-unquote, multiple personalities. And that, to me, just seems totally disingenuous with a real DID case.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think it was unwell, but I don't think DID was what was going on. After a year of communicating, Gypsy did actually confess to Goldujahn that she didn't need the wheelchair and she had told him about what was going on at home. So at this point, the two began to discuss options about how to get Gypsy away from DD and out of the house. The first plan was to get Gypsy pregnant so that DD would have to let them marry, which I think is a funny echo of DD's own past.
Yep.
The problem was that Goldujahn lived hours away in another state in Wisconsin, so this was easier said than done. It wasn't as if he could just nip through the window for a quickie. Next, Gypsy proposed staging a chance encounter so that Nick could be introduced to DD and hopefully win her over. So in March 2015, she arranged that Goldujahn would attend the opening performance of Disney's live-action Cinderella movie, which is where her mother and herself would also be, and the 3 of them could all bump into each other there. Gypsy used money that she'd stolen from her mother to pay for Godajohn's bus ticket and hotel room, and the pair, and this just says so much about their relationship and how juvenile it is, sort of, it all seems quite innocent at this point. The pair arranged to coordinate their outfits, so Gypsy dressed in her Cinderella cosplay, and Nick came in a matching blue suit and tie as her Prince Charming. There's a picture of them. I'll put it on the Instagram. They've taken a selfie together. And they do look very sweet and very young. And if it hadn't have been for all these dreadful things that happen, you'd just think they're a cute little teenage couple. It's really sad. It's really sad. Dee Dee took an instant dislike to Godajohn, though, at the theatre. She declared him creepy for coming to a kid's movie alone and didn't like the way that he and Gypsy were cozying up together. At the theatre, Gypsy actually slipped off for a bathroom break and signalled for Godajohn to come with her, grabbing his hand. In the foyer, she pulled him into the men's bathroom, and here the two had sex. This is how Gypsy lost her virginity, then returned to watch the rest of the movie.
Okay.
They both say it happened. People doubt it, but they both say it happened. I'm inclined to believe them.
Well, from what you've kind of said, been thinking about it for a very long fucking time.
Yeah, I think it was an act of rebellion because her mum didn't like him.
Yeah, I can see that as a rebellion.
Yeah. Gypsy claims that after this, on the way home and once they got back, she fought furiously with her mother, and that Dee Dee began referring to her as a tramp and a whore, and that her choosing to spend time with Godajohn at the movie theatre rather than her had ruined their special day. It was after this incident that Gypsy decided there was no way out from her mother's control. Clearly, Dee Dee could not even consider allowing her to have an external relationship. So Gypsy began to proposition Godajohn to kill her mother. Quote.
It was her idea?
It was her idea.
Okay, fair enough.
So, direct quote from Gypsy. It didn't really come up like, I want you to kill her. But he'd said to me, I'll protect you from anybody. And I said, anybody? And he said, yeah. And I said, even my mum. And he said, yeah. And that's where it kind of developed from there on. We would refer to it as our plan B. Over the following months, Gypsy and Godajohn plotted how best to kill Dee Dee, discussing things through texts and instant messages. There's so much evidence. At first, they considered poisoning Dee Dee with some of the multitudes of medication within the house, but ultimately they settled on using a knife. Gypsy shared details with Godajohn of Dee Dee's sleeping habits, where floorboards might creak, and what items he would need, meticulously planning every step. Once again, Gypsy paid for a bus ticket for Godajohn to travel to Missouri. On the 10th of June 2015, Gypsy and Dee Dee had another argument, but ultimately made up, and painted one another's fingernails hot pink before Dee Dee took some sleeping pills and turned in for the night. Gypsy claims that her mother's last words to her were, I'm beginning to feel more relaxed. Don't hurt me.
Yeah. What?
I think at that point she knew that eventually Gypsy was going to snap. Outside the house, Godajohn was waiting. Once Dee Dee was asleep, Gypsy texted him to tell him it was time. He replied when she'd given him the gloves and the knife to get her ass into the bathroom. Gypsy let him inside, handed him the murder weapon, a pair of blue latex gloves, then retreated to the bathroom as ordered. She claims that she was in there in the fetal position, pressing her hands over her ears, but Godajohn claims that she was in there shaving her legs and her private parts. Godajohn stabbed Dee Dee a total of 17 times, but according to his police interviews, he can only remember the first four. To me, this is a prime example of overkill, and I think it indicates that there's a great deal of rage in Godajohn. Not necessarily just against Dee Dee, but in general, I think there's a lot of suppressed anger there.
Yeah.
After she was dead, Godajohn had Gypsy clean up some of her mother's blood naked because it turned him on. He said that he wanted to rape Dee Dee, but Gypsy says that she would not allow this and bargained with Godajohn that he could rape her instead. The two had sex in Gypsy's bedroom while her mother lay dead in the other room. Then they packed a bag, emptied Dee Dee's safe of $4,000, and booked a taxi to a hotel. I don't know how I feel about her saying that she said that Nick could rape her instead. As a woman, I don't like the idea of questioning other women about the idea of rape. But you see other killer couples where after they murder someone, they have celebratory sex. So this is one of those moments where I'm like, do I believe you? Unpopular opinion. At the hotel, the two played around in the room there, and there is video footage of Gypsy filming a near-naked Godijon eating a brownie on the bed. She can be heard giggling behind the camera and saying, quote, "He's eating a brownie, but later he will be eating me." She claims at the time she wasn't thinking about what they'd just done. She was simply thrilled at being free, and that she was on a large dose of Xanax, which, obviously, as we've discussed in episode one, can fuck up your emotions. In the following days, the pair mailed the murder weapon to Godijon's home address, then took a bus back to Wisconsin. Gypsy says that they did this because she thought that there would be metal detectors on the bus and that the safest thing to do would be to send it in the mail because people mail knives all the time. You know, that's how you get your stuff from the cosplay store.
What?
I think, doesn't that show, though, how naive she is and how little experience with the world she has?
Yeah.
That she thought that there'd be metal detectors in the bus.
Did it get delivered?
Yep.
Really?
Yep.
See, my main concern was, like, it would chew up the mail machine.
It was in a jiffy bag.
Okay.
It's in a jiffy bag. And she's right. Stuff does, like that, does get mailed in all the time.
Yeah? Well, I'll have to do next time I post a knife.
I ordered my brother a set of Sabatier knives for his birthday.
You did?
A few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Very large, very sharp ones. They went through the post.
Yeah, but...
The logic sound.
See, so I'm just picturing them, like, literally getting an A4 envelope, open, put the knife in, seal it, postbox.
That's what they did. That's what they did.
It's a jiffy bag, though.
It's in a jiffy bag, but yeah, that's what they did. They are not master criminals.
No, they're not.
When they arrived in Wisconsin, the pair told Godijon's mother and stepfather that Gypsy had been kicked out of her mum's house and had been living in a homeless shelter, so Nicholas's parents agreed that she could live with them. They had no idea that Gypsy had been in a wheelchair previously. They thought she was a perfectly normal girl. And they said in police interviews later, the only thing that they thought was a little bit odd about her was that she was clearly wearing a wig. Bless them. Not a sausage.
No.
Not a sausage. Now, remember those Facebook messages?
Mm-hmm.
The really, really vile ones.
Yep.
That led to Dee Dee being discovered. It was Gypsy who posted those messages on Facebook, not Nick. She says when she's asked why she did this, it was because she wanted her mother's body to be found so that she could have a proper burial, and that she felt she had to post something really alarming in order to do this. She also said that she didn't think at the time that she would be caught. She didn't consider anything like IP addresses. She thought that she would just disappear into the system as a missing person and eventually be able to have her happily ever after.
Mm.
Which, again, with that naivety, I can believe...
Yeah.
You know? It is difficult, though, to know what to believe when Gypsy tells you something. She has been shaped into a professional liar and actress by her mother. On videos of her police interrogation after her arrest, she feigns total ignorance of her mother's death and sobs about how much she loves her mother while simultaneously incriminating Nick. In contrast, during Godijon's interviews, he appears very calm and honest, and he tells the interviewing officer plainly that yes, he killed Dee Dee, but that he loves Gypsy madly, and he wouldn't ever have done it or even considered it if it hadn't have been for Gypsy asking him. He only did it for love. At her original arraignment hearing, when family and friends watched her walk into court, Gypsy sobbed once more before making a not guilty plea to murder in the first degree in her high-pitched, childlike voice. She and Godijon were extradited back to Springfield to await trial, and it was at this point that Gypsy had her case severed from Nicholas's. They would be tried separately for their joint crime. Gypsy was assigned a public defender, Michael Stanfield, who drew the case at random and had no idea what he was getting into. This poor bastard. He says he works about 270 cases a year, and they're normally pretty simple. And even the murder ones that he might occasionally work, because it's Springfield, you know.
Yeah.
They tend to be very cut and dry, and then this fucking thing landed on his desk.
Bloody hell. Open folder, like, right, that's what we've got. Oh.
Yeah, and he's just a public defender. He's not, you know, a specialised, you know, murder lawyer or anything like that.
There must have been a few stiff drinks.
Not like OJ's dream team, but Rod and Christy were really impressed with him. Over the following year, Michael, Rod, and Rod's wife, Christy, so Gypsy's stepmother, worked to piece together the best they could just how Gypsy and Dee Dee's lives had come to this point. It made for a horrifying exploration of medical abuse, and there were such mitigating circumstances that they were ultimately able to negotiate a plea deal with the state. In exchange for a guilty plea to the lesser charge of second-degree murder, on the 5th of July, Gypsy was sentenced to 10 years in prison, with a requirement that she serves 85% of her sentence before she was eligible for parole. Her sentence includes time served for the year that she spent in jail awaiting her trial, so this means that Gypsy will be eligible for parole in 2023 at the age of 32. Nicholas Godejohn, however, did not make such a deal, and he went to trial in November 2018. His defence team argued that due to his Asperger's syndrome, he could not be held culpable for the crime and was not capable of the premeditation required to warrant a first-degree murder charge. The prosecution, though, were quick to refer to the wealth of messaging evidence with Gypsy over several months, where Godejohn took an active role in planning Dee Dee's death, and in the days running up to the murder, he even seemed to be enjoying it. Gypsy took the stand at Godejohn's trial and in court took responsibility for inciting her mother's death. She stated it was entirely her idea and that she had talked Godejohn into it. She explained that for her part, it was so that she could be free from her mother. Godejohn maintains to this day that he did it purely for love of Gypsy. The jury were not swayed by any of this, though, and in February 2019, Godejohn was found guilty of murder in the first degree and sentenced to a life sentence without the possibility of parole. His first appeal against his sentence has already been denied. Gypsy herself has actually thrived in prison. While she was awaiting her trial, her attorney Michael noted, "Most of my clients lose weight in prison because the food is so terrible." In her first year, Gypsy gained 14 pounds. That's one stone.
Okay.
Which says a lot, I think, about her life before.
Go for it, girl.
Gypsy had been taken off of all her medication with no ill effects. She had her feeding tube removed and the site has healed over. She's had her teeth fixed. Her hair has grown out and she has learned how to style it and do her makeup. Other women within the prison are very protective of her. She's also built a relationship with her father, Rob, and her stepmother, Christy, who visit her as often as they can. In 2019, she was briefly engaged to a man that she met originally as a pen pal after he began writing to her when he heard of her case, but the engagement was ultimately called off. Gypsy's family stated that she wanted to focus on herself for the time being. I have to say, I think that's the right decision.
Oh, definitely.
You don't want history to repeat itself if you're going to learn anything from it. He might have been a wonderful man, but Gypsy needs to develop her own identity first, I think.
Yeah, and she's been under like this cruel woman's abuse for so many years. She needs time to be herself and learn herself. And it sounds like she is enjoying being able to develop her own person.
And I think as well, you know, as much as she might succeed in prison, she's not going to become a fully formed person there. She needs to live on her own in the outside world for a little while as well before she starts looking at love again.
But while she's during her time in prison, she has been able to become a person.
Yeah, she's working on it.
It's good. It's positive development.
Mm-hmm. So, like you said, while she's in prison, she's completing her education, so she's working towards her GED. And the prison that she's incarcerated in, the Chillicothe Correctional Centre, I had a look at their website and it seems to be they're very focused on rehabilitation and preventing repeat offending. So they offer therapy. She goes to therapy once a week. They also offer vocational courses, skills training and hobby shops. And they also do a lovely thing called puppies for parole.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Yep, so basically offenders that are due to go on parole shortly, they will be given a puppy to train as a service dog for someone in the outside world that teaches them responsibility, gives them a life skill, and also I think helps them develop a relationship, which has to be good for their mental health shortly. And that's proved really successful. So Gypsy has said that she feels freer now in prison than she ever did while living with her mother. Now, she does make all the right noises. She tells people that she doesn't want to be the liar that her mother taught her to be. She wants to be a good person. She says that she's happy she's free, but she's not happy that her mother is dead. She says that she proposed her mother's death, but it was Nick who ultimately put it into action. And on reflection, if she'd done anything differently, she wished that she had told her father how much trouble she was in. She says that she was deeply in love with Nick at the time, but no longer is, and now knows the difference between love and infatuation. She speaks very beautifully. She is eloquent and very clearly intelligent despite her limited education. She cries when she speaks of her mother. It's easy to think of Gypsy as blameless and a victim only, and say that she doesn't deserve to be in prison. And perhaps, if she herself had been the one to kill her mother, I do wonder if she'd been able to just walk free entirely on a case of self-defence. I genuinely believe...
That has happened before.
Yeah, that happens with domestic abuse cases. Yeah. If the woman kills her abuser, they will be allowed to, you know, defend themselves on the ground of self-defence. Yeah. And not serve prison time and not face criminal charges. And I do wonder if Gypsy had been the one to kill Dee Dee on her own, if that had been the case. The problem is, though, that she did bring Nicholas Godejohn into it. Now, this is a young man that committed a crime he stated he otherwise never would have even considered. And it is likely that Godejohn never would have murdered anybody if he had not been primed to by Gypsy. I did say at the beginning of this case in episode one that there were multiple victims, and I still stand by that now. Gypsy and Dee Dee are two of them. I feel that Nicholas Godejohn is another. And so is Rod Blanchard, who still now blames himself for not seeing what was happening and taking Gypsy away. Gypsy has given several interviews since her sentencing. She's the subject of documentaries, fictionalised television shows and films, books, as well as podcasts just like this one. Some people feel that she is doing just as her mother did, manipulating the media for sympathy and attention. Some feel, and to be honest, I'm one of these people, that she is just making the most of having her own voice for the first time in 23 years.
Yeah.
Which is what I feel. I don't think she's being manipulative of the media, at least not to any degree that Dee Dee was. I think she just wants to speak.
Yeah. Well, like when she was seven... She was out of the chair, running around and playing. As soon as her mum appeared, she's on the floor again.
Yeah, and like the footage of Dee Dee squeezing her hand to control her in interviews. Yep. It's on camera.
Yeah.
She's never been allowed to have her own voice. And now everybody wants to hear her story. Let her fucking talk.
And the two times she almost got away, her mum swooped down and said, she's 14 years old.
Yeah.
You're a monster.
And she was just dismissed. And finally, she's being heard.
Yeah. Okay, I can understand that.
So, I mean, there may be a degree of manipulation in it, because at the end of the day, it's not like she has an income or anything, and she's probably getting paid for all of this. Yeah.
But also, you've got to remember, with sometimes these behaviours can, not by any kind of intent or will, they can pass down.
Absolutely.
Because it's a behaviour that's witnessed and absorbed.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it like can go from mother to daughter.
Yeah. Absolutely, it can be generational, which we may well have seen between Dee Dee and her mother. The long-standing effects of Dee Dee's abuse on Gypsy are clear. While she has been fortunately left with no obvious physical health effects other than still needing to wear glasses, she is tiny. She stands at 4'11" tall, and even now she's gained weight, she comes in at 100 pounds. It's about 8 stone.
That's not much.
No. In fact, it might be less. I'm going to have to work that out now. I don't work in American. I don't work in American.
We don't work in American. We have electric kettles and we don't make
tea. She's just over 7 stone.
And we don't make tea in the microwave. It's wrong.
Are you finished?
If all of America knows that you shouldn't make tea in the microwave, then yes, I'm finished.
Okay.
Make sure you share this episode just for this message alone. Thank you. Carry on.
So this height and the low weight that she has is likely due to the array of medication that she was on during her developing years, and also obviously her limited calorie intake from being in a feeding tube.
Fucking feeding tube.
She also still has the childlike, high-pitched voice. People used to think that she was faking this, but actually, that high-pitched little girl voice is recognised within the mental health circles as a side effect of deep psychological trauma to young children. It's a side effect that basically prevents that their vocal patterns and their sort of vocal maturity from developing. So it's not something that she's putting on. It's a hangover from the abuse that she endured. It's also, though, not just the physical effects that Gypsy has been left with. Christy and Rod say that they still catch her in lies about her life. They also say that she is very wary to trust others. When interviewers ask Gypsy about her abuse and something seems too hard to discuss, she will suddenly revert back to her practiced brave girl demeanour for the camera and say things like, "It's okay, it just made me stronger." Dee Dee's own family feel that Gypsy should not be in prison and that she has suffered enough. They lost no love for Dee Dee after her murder, and when the funeral home contacted her to ask what they should do with Dee Dee's ashes, they told them that they didn't want them and that they should flush them down the toilet.
You've got to remember, it's not just Gypsy as well. It's
she's inflicted suffering on her whole family.
Yeah, it's, well, her own mother.
Well, not any of that, the credit card fraud and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
She has her track record.
Yeah, it's not like she was a fantastic person. Yeah.
But they despise her for what she did to Gypsy.
Yeah.
Gypsy does have my unending sympathy for what she endured. I do believe that any complicity that she may have had in Dee Dee's financial frauds and schemes, it's not because she wanted to partake, it was because she was conditioned to, and that she was abused into that behaviour, and it was the only life that she knew. People seem to think that some people seem to think that Gypsy's equally complicit in all the scams that Dee Dee ran. I don't think that's true. I think even when she cooperated, it was because it was the only life that she knew.
Yeah.
And Dee Dee probably threatened her. You know, well, you're as guilty as I am in this. If I go to prison, so will you.
Mm-hmm.
I really hope that the things that Gypsy tells the interviewers that she meets with are true. I hope that she will break the mould of factitious disorder being commonly a generational one that passes from perpetrator to victim to victim. I hope that when she comes out of prison, she will be the best version of herself that she can be. I personally don't think that Nicholas Dojajon should be in prison. I think he should be in a secure hospital. Somewhere like Broadmoor.
Which we learned recently.
Yeah.
In, was it last episode or episode
first
four?
First episode. John George Hague. I really feel that his mental health was not properly taken into account at his trial. The problem is that getting a conviction or a lack of conviction on grounds of culpability, mental culpability, is so difficult, and the parameters of sanity in legal terms are so specific. His legal team just couldn't win because he was involved in premeditation. And I think he's too sick to be in prison. I think he needs to be hospitalised.
What's saying about the guidelines being so specific?
Mm.
Episode one, he tried to say he was a vampire.
Yeah.
People will lean on insanity and mental health to try and swing things the other way.
Oh, yeah. But Nicholas Godejon genuinely believed that he had multiple personality disorder and that he heard voices. I think he was a very ill young man. And unfortunately, he was fucked because of the text messages he had with Gypsy. Yeah. He should be in a hospital. He shouldn't be treated like other criminals of a similar calibre, because I don't think he is. The problem is that I don't know if I can say the same thing about Gypsy. I don't know if she should be in a prison or a hospital. She is the one that incited Nick to murder, and she does acknowledge that with a sort of strange calmness about her that could come off as not having any remorse. It could as easily, though, just be emotional detachment from a traumatic experience, which is something you see a lot. People who've gone through something absolutely horrific will talk about it very candidly.
We've got to remember as well, she literally had freedom in her hands twice.
Uh-huh.
And her mother stole it away. So, you know, that is going to build into a deep seething hatred.
Huge fury.
Yeah,
huge hatred.
Which can evolve into, just fucking kill her.
Yeah.
Do me a favour and kill her.
But does that mean that just because she suffered that, does that mean that murdering her mother is okay? Murder's never the way it's supposed to be.
No. I'm not saying it's okay. I'm just explaining how I can understand emotion towards that.
I can 1,000% understand it. I don't agree with it, but I can completely understand it. I mean, some people posit that maybe Gypsy should have been put in a hospital. Some people posit that maybe she should have done half in prison, half in hospital. It's a completely unprecedented situation. This is the first known case of a Munchausen's by proxy victim killing their abuser, so there's no precedent for how she should be treated in a criminal context. Yeah. So they gave her 10 years in prison because they didn't know what else to do. Yeah. And, it means that she's getting out. She's going to have a life. Yeah.
And like you've already covered, she is now like developing her own identity.
Yeah, she is.
For her, still kind of a win.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I just worry if being in the penal system is going to help her to properly learn to be a functional adult on her own two feet. I don't know if it can rehabilitate her enough. But I also don't know if just putting her in a hospital for 10 years would help her understand the gravity of what she'd done to her mother. How do you make a call like that?
No, yeah.
You can't.
Well, I don't think she'll ever develop independence.
No,
because
I don't think she'll ever be completely independent.
Because the other women in the prison she's with are very protective of her.
Yes.
So she already has that new care structure.
She does. And Rod and Christy have said that when she comes out, she's going to live with them. And I don't know if she will ever be able to be quote-unquote normal. No. And that's not her fault. How could she possibly be normal with the upbringing that she had?
Well, the point of her life where she would have developed independence, she didn't get it.
Yeah.
She's not had that chance
to
develop.
She's not had any of it.
No.
So, wherever Gypsy is, I personally, probably an unpopular opinion, but I don't think that she should be free, not yet. I think she needs to serve her time. As Mark Felden, the expert on factitious disorders, said of her, Gypsy does not have a language beyond manipulation and retaliation. She's not had a chance to be normal, and she now needs to go through a crash course on how to be a functioning human being in the world outside of the one that Dee Dee created for her.
Mm-hmm.
Gypsy is the product her mother created. She probably will also be the only one who knows the whole truth of what went on in the Pink Bungalow. What she chooses to do with her life when she gets out of prison will be the true testament as to whether she is really free or if she's just a reflection of Dee Dee. And that is the story of Gypsy Rose Blanchard.
So far.
I hope she proves all of us doubters wrong. I don't want to doubt her, but I feel like pinch of salt, you know?
Yeah.
Somebody's dead at the end of the day.
Yeah. I dare say we'll probably end up revisiting this story at some point when more information's come out.
Well, I think she's trying to campaign for early parole next year at the moment.
Mm.
There's a petition and stuff going round. It's just so sad, the entire thing. And I feel desperately sorry for Nicholas as well. I don't think he had any real comprehension of the finality of what he was doing.
No. But they did it together.
They did it together.
They did it together.
They did it together.
And he
got the harsher sentence.
Yeah. But he put his hand up and said, yeah, didn't it?
Yeah, he did. Ugh, I'm sad now.
Shall we do some criminally stupid?
Can I have a criminally stupid, please? Can I have a criminally stupid, please? I need something to make me giggle.
Okay, so, do you remember last week's story?
About the man falling asleep mid-robbery, buried in Doritos and half a pie.
Yes, that
I
was
do,
the one.
Because I also decided to do a little Google of Buckfast after that. For those of you who don't know what Buckfast wine is, it is a tonic wine from Scotland that tastes like methylated spirits and cough syrup and gets you very, very drunk and is known to get you a very certain type of drunk, which is normally being a prick. So I was doing a little Google of Buckfast and I discovered something called, what was it called? Oh, bollocks. It's Buckfast Tonic and Red Bull.
Oh.
I think it's called Turbo Wine. And apparently that shit just sends you totally fucking round the bend.
Dear.
Can you imagine all these lads in Glasgow off their faces on Buckfast and Red Bull? Vodka and Red Bull was bad enough. That's something you've probably never been exposed to, but I used to get smashed on it when I was a teenager and it properly fucked me up. Can you imagine putting Buckfast into the mix?
None of this sounds fun.
But give me a criminally stupid anyway, sorry.
Okay, right. So, what would you say got the man caught last time?
He fell asleep.
Yeah, that was the main thing that kind of gave away that he was doing something he shouldn't be doing.
Well, yeah, because he fell asleep in somebody else's house.
Now, what else do you think leaving behind... If you were doing a robbery, a theft in a shop, what wouldn't you want to leave behind that would get you caught?
My fingerprints.
Try again.
My DNA.
Try again.
My tread pattern off the soles of my shoes.
No, something bigger than that.
Something bigger than that.
Yeah.
My baby. No! No, that was a guess. I swear to God, I've never heard of this.
So, this happened this year, in June, in Berlin. Baltese police said that on Saturday, a 29-year-old suspect ran off with €5.
€5.
Worth of goods he was trying to steal, but he triggered the alarm and fucking legged it and forgot his 8-year-old son.
Oh my God!
So the police could then go up to his 8-year-old son and say, do fucking Detective John Kimball, who's your daddy and what does he do? And they found where his, they found his dad in a matter of, let me see.
That poor child.
Didn't say how long, but the culprit was quickly identified.
Oh, that poor child. Did they place him? Where's his mum?
This is the whole story.
That's the entire... That's the entire story.
But here's the thing. He didn't actually make a successful escape. He fell over on the way out and ended up in hospital.
Oh,
like, where's your dad?
What a bastard.
He's in the street in a puddle of his own blood.
Rightly so. Don't abandon your child after you've implicated them in a crime scene.
So not only did his dad abandon him, but he's also a fucking idiot.
This is a clear indicator not to go into the family business.
No, don't go into the family business.
Fuck me, sideways.
Well, I would say that would serve as a good example to maybe do right as he grows up, would you reckon?
Hopefully so. Hopefully so.
So that's this week's Criminally Stupid.
Thank you. Well, thanks for listening, guys. If you've made it this far, well done. Hopefully you've felt the benefit of the improved sound quality. We are getting there slowly but surely. If you would like to interact with us, you can follow us on Twitter at DeviantCrimePod, Instagram at DeviantCrimePodcast, or on Facebook, you can join our group at Deviant, a True Crime Podcast. You can also email us at DeviantCrimePodcast@gmail.com. Please rate, review and subscribe.
And share
your friends. We're very new. We're trying to get better. We'd love to hear from you. If you've got case suggestions or queries or funny stories you'd like to tell us, or horrible stories you'd like to tell us, really.
Yeah.
We'd just like to hear from you. So until next time, thanks very much for listening and don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick.
And remember... Sometimes murder isn't the answer.
You're horrible. Bye, everybody.
Bye.